welcome into the Who's On podcast, part of the Sabre Podcast Network. We're here to dip into some football after Virginia's final home game of the season, the finale at Scott Stadium. Not a great one. Virginia losing 33-7 to SMU, the number 13 team in the country. They still got some college football playoff hopes alive as they clinch a spot in the ACC championship game. Virginia, on the other hand, they still need one more win to get to bowl eligibility. And today, we got none other than Ahmad Hawkins, the Ball Hawk, joining us here, one of the color analysts for Virginia on the radio, joining us now to talk about this. And Ahmad, thanks for coming on. First of all, since the last time you came, we started a new thing. We call it the Big Take, the capital B-I-G. What was your big take coming out of this game against SMU?
Oh, the big take is I can't curse. Well, we got belt to hind parts yet again at home. So that's the big take.
I think that's pretty much sums it up. Yeah. I kind of used one word when I was walking out of there and I couldn't think of a better word. It's not a fancy word. It's not like a UVA education word. It was just lame. Like the game was lame. The reasoning afterward was lame. Just a lot of things surrounding it were lame. I just couldn't think of a better word than that afterwards. Let's get into some of the big talking points. And obviously there's one big one. That's the one that, you know, drew five or six questions in the postgame press conference about the quarterback situation. And I know Tony Elliott said going into the week, he wanted to avoid a quarterback controversy. He's not making a controversy. And so I called it a situation. It might be dipping a little bit more past the line into controversy at this point. I know we'll get into kind of the nuances of it, but I wanted to play this soundbite from Tony Elliott on kind of why he stuck with Anthony Calandria, why he never went to Tony Musket. I know a lot of us in the press box were like, all right, Tony's grabbing his helmet. Nope, he put it back down. But let's play this soundbite, just hear from Tony Elliott in his words before we get into it.
When we're dealing with the quarterback, that's a very, very sensitive situation. So, you know, the plan was internal. Florida game, I throw Tony out there, we can't protect Tony. You know, and so in fairness to either quarterback, I think it's a tough situation. Now, if it was clean pockets and missed throws, bad decisions, then I think you make a change. But I also know that you make a change, then that's your permanent change. And I felt like AC had earned the right to be able to respond. And if the response wasn't the way that it needed to be, then obviously we needed to make a change. But it's hard to gauge a kid's response when, you know, all the things around him, you know, are not necessarily helping him.
All right, Tony Elliott, you heard the reasoning there, and it was a lot of what other people on the offense were doing. So obviously offensive line gives up 9 sacks. Anthony Calandria, you know, the running backs, you were down 2 guys in Xavier Brown and Kobe Pace. And you're down to Noah Vaughn and Dante Hawthorne playing snaps at running back. The wide receivers weren't getting open. But then on the flip side, Anthony Calandria, 18-27, 108 yards, and one a Hail Mary from the 4-yard line, as I like to call it. Just what did you make overall of the offense and, I guess, just the decision by Tony Elliott to stick with Calandria?
First, I'm going to just elephant in the room. I wasn't surprised. That's like Tony's track record as a head coach here. And I know he wasn't the head coach at Clemson, but the one time they changed at Clemson was Trevor Lawrence for Bryant, and Trevor Lawrence was the younger guy. But coach, even in an interview, I want to say it's with John Freeman, he even referenced like DJU, how he threw like 17 interceptions and they still kept him in as a quarterback. So when I heard that, I was just like, he's not going to change. Like, he's faithful to his opening day starter. He was like that with Tony Musket last year after JMU, when fans saw Andy Calandria, the excitement that he brought to the table. And when Tony was coming back and he got the reins, everybody was like, we should start Calandria. He's going to stay with a starter. So I understand both sides. I understand why coach is sticking with Calandria, because that's his MO. And I understand why fans want Tony Musket. Tony Musket was a guy that I felt like should have been a starter from day one, because it's easier to pull the older guy and go with the younger guy versus the younger guy going with the older guy. And he even made a statement, said if he makes the changes, it's permanent. And I think people didn't realize the context he was speaking. He wasn't saying if he pulled him during the game. He was saying if he started Tony, then Tony's the permanent starter now moving forward. So I think that got kind of confused. Cause I got what he's, I understand why people was like, but you putting in, even in my podcast, I said, once we got down by 20, we usually put Tony in the game. Clemson, yeah. We put him in the game. Notre Dame, we put him in the game. Carolina, put him in the game. Like, so it was like, hey, we down by 20. So I was surprised we didn't see Tony at all.
Yeah, again, like we were saying, watching the sideline, seeing him pick up the helmet, seeing him put the helmet back down, and it just he never did it. And I'm wondering if it was because, you know, there was so much made about it earlier in the week, and he didn't want to kind of have that public scene. And I asked him after the game, like, when you make this decision, do you announce it to the team? Like, how do you communicate that? And did he get the feeling the team was kind of behind it? He didn't address that second part of the question, but he said, you know, they made a decision Friday. It was all kept internal. They don't want to make a public announcement because they don't make a public announcement for, you know, the starting right guard between Ty Furnish and Yuga Nana, who's going to start. Yeah, that's true. But this is a different position. This is different. And I get, you know, keeping the element of surprise for SMU, but no one was surprised to see Anthony Calandria tried out there with the ones and get the start. And I wonder, like, do you get his reasoning? Because he said that, you know, you didn't want to switch quarterbacks because, you know, Anthony Calandria was already in so much duress back there. You know, there's at least three or four of those nine sacks where, you know, SMU just kind of bum rushed and got straight through and got to the quarterback before he even made his drop. So he didn't want to put Tony Musket in that situation. But at the same time, before that last touchdown, it was 20 straight drives Anthony Calandria without a score on offense. That's field goal or touchdown.
Yeah, I mean, so again, I'm a fair person. A lot of times being fair get me in trouble and people call me an apologist. So when I hear a coach say something, I got to X out how I truly feel because I'm going to be human and say, I don't buy that because we want the answer that's formulated in our head. So from his standpoint, I understand where you're coming from, right? So the first sack we gave up, our right guard just punches the D tackle and looks at the end and lets him through. And then another time we have one of our young backs just whiff versus the linebacker and they get a sack. Then another time our receivers just don't get open. This is the first time in a long time no receivers got open on a play and they bull rushed both of our ends and just took them to Calandria. So I get the standpoint of it's hot back there. Is it really 10's fault right now? Other games, when he turned the ball over, you could say it's 10's fault. But here's where I, being a former player and understand and being a former receiver, I'm like, but not the second guess coach, but I'm like, but coach, the guy on the sideline can actually alleviate some of that pressure because his advantage over Calandria is pre-snap read. Being able to process information once the ball snaps. He's quicker to get the ball out. And another reason why I felt like Tony would have helped us, this is just my opinion, not a fact. Once they started playing bump and run, Malachi feels it's going to really become a cheat code when you got seven back there because he's going to back shoulder throw. We saw with the quarterback from SMU who wore number seven as well, what he did when Jonas Sanker had their tight end dead to rights, just blanketed covered, he threw a back shoulder throw. So I feel like Tony's skill set would have alleviated that pressure. Not saying they wouldn't have got any sacks with Tony in there because Tony's been sacked as well in relief duty. But I just felt like when a team's playing man-to-man, when they're pressing you, when they're showing you five, if it's available within your scheme, he may make a sight adjustment. Hey, Neville, you're uncovered. Look for the ball right now. Tyree, they playing you 7 yards off. Look for the ball right now. Hey, Malachi, we're going fade. If it's in the offensive scheme, because I don't know what type of side adjustment they had pre-snap, but I do know this, seven is better before the snap than 10. 10 is better when the pocket breaks down than seven. Seven throws the ball better versus man-to-man on the outside, on the numbers, than 10. 10 is just electric. Seven isn't willing to be electric, but he is the top-end speed. Like, he's faster than Calandria, but he's not the willing runner. So I just felt like, me personally, and I'm, you know, sentimental. It's senior day. Like, come on, man. Put my dog Tony Musket in the game, coach.
I was surprised when we got to halftime and they still had not scored and we didn't see Tony Muscat come out in the second half. I was surprised by that because I think at that point you kind of, and Tony Elliott talked about it in the build-up to the week, you kind of owe it to your seniors to give it all you can and try everything you can to win a game like that. And it just kind of felt like, and this is kind of where the lame comes in, it just felt like you didn't do it, and the reasoning behind it didn't kind of satisfy, and it probably never will after a loss like that, but it didn't satisfy, you know, why you wouldn't do it in that situation. And with Kalander, and you mentioned Kevin Jennings, the quarterback from SMU, I find it interesting. He only had three rush attempts in this game. He had the touchdown later on, but he used his legs, but it was not to run. It was to set up the pass. And I think that's what the coaching staff thinks they're going to get out of Anthony Kalandria. That's what they see, you know, when they talk about, you know, when your offensive line can't hold up and he can kind of extend the play and get his receivers open. That just hasn't happened at all this year. You know, he will get outside the pocket, but I don't know if he's just not seeing the field well, or, you know, if the receivers aren't running the scramble drill well. Know, he mentioned that against Notre Dame when Xavier Brown kind of ran down the field and cut inside instead of staying, you know, further down the sideline. He mentioned that. So that's one reason why I bring that up. But it doesn't seem like it's working the way that they thought it would. And it's not even working the way it was last year. I mean, I know Malik Washington was a huge part of that, but they were fourth in the ACC in passing yards last year. And now they're, I think, 11th or 12th.
Yeah. I mean, we took a big shot when Terrell Harris got hurt too. So you didn't have anybody truly threatening vertically. So that's been an issue as well. We don't take shots down the field. We just really don't. We really just don't. We refuse to throw past 15 yards down the field, and defenses and safeties sit on their hash and they just chop at their sticks and they coming downhill and everything. And when we do have Malachi, one-on-one, when we attempt to throw down the field versus him, we throw to Malachi, and it's not a knock on Malachi, but we throw to him like he's a true speed guy that you even leaving type of receiver. He's 6'4", 220. If he's even, throw it to the outside numbers, back shoulder, like throw it up. That him moss people. Like, well, Hassis Dubois, like you saw when Bryce Perkins had Hassis. Hassis wasn't a burner, but if he was one-on-one, he was going to eight. He was going to him. And you put it on that back shoulder, let you use your strong hands. And I think that's been a disservice to just the offense in itself. And that's why I always come back to that quarterback position, because I understand at this point of Kalandria's career, that's not his strong suit. That's just not. It's not a knock on him. Me dissing him is just not in his strong suit. So I understand you want to develop the young quarterback. You picked him as a starter, so you do have to stick with him. You really do. I mean, that's just – coaches don't have the luxury that we do as fans of just saying, just play him, it ain't going to hurt nothing. It can hurt something. Yeah. It really can. It really can. And it can hurt if people are backing Musket wanting to play too. Don't get me wrong. I know some people in that locker room like, dang, you ain't going to get seven a chance, because as we stated, you stated earlier, other positions you don't make announcements, but other positions you would have been rotated. We done seen if a corner struggle, another corner come in. We done seen if a linebacker struggle, another linebacker come in, or another lineman come in. You know, the list goes on and on. But one position, and I done seen Georgia Tech run two quarterbacks and beat Miami. So y'all could, all the people say, if you got two, you got none. That's old school. We in a new era. You use as many as you can to get the job done. If the results are positive, all that old school adage goes out the window. So if you stand true to the old school way of one quarterback, you keep losing one quarterback, you might have to switch it up, because everything doesn't fit everybody. All these sayings and stuff. I came from Coach Walsh. I want you to put a fullback in there, go I formation on the center, and go student body left, student body right. But I know that's not the age we live in. So I have a growth mindset, is what I'm saying. So, yeah, man, it's just a shame that Tony didn't get in, because he's been getting in when games have gone that way.
Yeah,
and for some reason, this game he didn't get in.
You would have liked to see just what would it look like? Just, you know, entertain us. Like, just show us what it would look like.
This is what it look like, what the defense going to say, because I know Tony going to sling it. Like, he going to come, and I think he came out versus Notre Dame. That was the most willing I ever seen him run since, you know, that North Carolina game last year where we won. But you saw, like, I know during the week when they were rotating, playing with the ones, and I said this in my podcast, so this is already documented. I would have been like, Coach, you wasting my time. Because that first interview, what did Coach say? Well, we had to play today. Anthony Calandra was a starter. Well, damn, that's one practice. So what's like come on, man. We in a practice where you going against scout team, where you got cue cards and everything script for you to be successful. Is that really a competition? And I'm not knocking the coaches. I'm just saying, from a former player, when I hear things, I'm going to be transparent. I'm like, that's what made me be like, man, you ain't going to lose your starting job in practice as a quarterback, as a running back or receiver. Like, receivers, you could drop balls and things like that. But quarterback, they look at that position. It's so coddled, and you're so taken care of that when you are the starter, you do get taken care of, unless, you know, you got an old ball coach who just don't care.
It does. You mentioned that word coddle, and it does seem like there's a lot of that right now, because in past weeks, you know, he would, you know, kind of critique, you know, oh, this interception, you know, he's kind of forcing it in there. After the game, I was kind of surprised just the direction it took. It was like, you know, it was the offensive line, it was the running backs, it was the receivers. Never really said anything about Calandra and what he did. And I think there's a couple plays in that game that I think, you know, I think of Noah Vaughn open in the flat. He was in the end zone.
Yeah.
And then
he was wide open.
He pump fake to the open guy, comes back around and fumbles the ball. And, you know, now you're had a loss. I think it was 18 yards.
Ethan Davies wide open on the sprint. Now we looking right at the running back the entire time. And each film, I'm looking at every angle. And I'm like, he never looks at Ethan. Ethan's wide open. And I'm just like, bro, and you're out the pocket. You're not getting pressured. So it's like, he's a New York Jet quarterback right now. He's seeing coasts in a sense. You know,
throwing back to Sam Darnold. I'm not an overreaction guy. I'm not a hot take guy. Mm-hmm. I've always kind of tried to play level. And, you know, after the UNC game, I was like, yeah, like it wasn't a great game by him. But I think too, like, you know, the offensive line didn't play their best. I think Blake Steen gets beat a lot off the right tackle spot. You know, looking at, you know, the receivers, I think, like you said, since Terrell Harris went down, like, there just hasn't been as much separation. And also, you know, question the play calling at times, like, I think a lot of people are kind of looking at right now. And I think after the Notre Dame game, I was like, I think almost all those interceptions were on him. And that's why I was like, I think now might be the time, because he also just doesn't look comfortable out there. And I don't think he's looked the same AC gunslinger kind of guy since the Maryland game. Honestly, I think it's been kind of he plateaued, where he wasn't turning the ball over. He wasn't hurting you, but he wasn't making the big plays. And now in the past couple of weeks, it's just kind of gone downhill. And again, he didn't have a turnover. He just didn't make the big plays against SMU. Let's get off the quarterbacks. I think that's enough. I'm fully expecting Anthony Calandra to start in Blacksburg. Is that kind of how you would feel right now?
Yeah. He'll come out as a starter, and you expect him to. I expect to see, like, anytime he step on the field, I expect to see the Anthony Calandra I saw in the second half versus Wake Forest, especially that fourth quarter. That mamma jamma in that fourth quarter versus Wake Forest was, that's the one once he showed me that, I'm like, man, listen, if you give me that, we ain't losing.
That's the reason so many people were excited coming into the year. It's funny how it's flipped, because last year, Tony Musket was the starter and the guy that Tony Elliott stuck with. And there was never a quarterback battle. It was just, is Tony healthy this week? Calandra would come in, be exciting. Fans would get excited about it. And then coming into this offseason, we're like, well, that's who I want. And so he starts, and first couple games go pretty well for him. And then it kind of starts to dip. And then now here we are again, like, but it's flipped. It's the opposite now. Calandra is entrenched as the starter, and Tony Musket's not the exciting guy to come in, but just the guy you're like, I need a steady arm. I need a steady arm right now, because the defense is playing well. You have enough of a running game, although I don't know right now with the injuries, but you have enough around him that it would be good, and you want to get that win to get to bowl eligibility. But let's talk about the running backs real quick. I just want to hear your thoughts on it. Obviously, Xavier Brown out for the season with a broken collarbone. Kobe Pace day to day with a knee injury. So all of a sudden, Noah Vonn is kind of your lead back out there, and you know he'd played a couple snaps here and there. And Tony Elliott's always spoken positively about Noah Vonn. And then Dante Hawthorne, who I believe Tony Elliott said earlier in the week was going to be out for this game, but then all of a sudden he was in the game. And so just kind of what do you think of this running back situation, especially now as you're getting ready to go to Blacksburg and Lane Stadium?
Oh, it's tricky. It's definitely tricky just for the pass pro. I know when Noah's in the game, we do a good job of featuring him in the passing game, whether it's slip screens or just anything out the backfield with him being that safety valve. I'm interested to see, because I know Jack Greasy is down, but are they gonna give Davis Lane
He's
any
the only
rep?
other guy.
I mean, you talking about somebody who could fly, like he's faster than Xavier. Like, that's the thing. Like, utilize every resource you got. You just never know. All you need is an opportunity. And if it comes down to pass pro and things like that, that's when you as an offensive coordinator, again, this is why I'm undefeated in the booth and I'm not a coach. Because I could just come with ideas and I can't get punished with if it don't work. But you start to move the pocket, you just feature your backs as pass catchers off the jump. Meaning you may have guys showing that you're going to blitz, but you going out. And I know if he trigger, I'm coming right to you. Or I got to find if the nick is going to trigger to you and they're going to pass off to the safety. But I'm going to make the defense adjust to how aggressive I am offensively with the pass options I got going out in the field. Because a lot of times we always been reactive to defenses. Like we see they bring an extra, we keep an extra guy in. It's like, no, send that extra guy out, but understand that he's getting the ball now. So it's all about the ability to process information. So the play caller may reflect what the quarterback can do. And a lot of times you do that because you want to make sure you keep him out of harm's way. But I will say this, if you call plays, allow Anthony Calandra to be aggressive, meaning quarterback powers, quarterback draws, is anything allowing him to be the guy, he plays better. If you ask him to facilitate, that's when he has the most issues. You know, it's like he's an organized chaos type of quarterback. Looks chaotic, but that's when he at his best, as
And
we
I
saw
think
twirl around Hail Mary touchdown throw.
it might be one of those things where you dust off the playbook from last year and you're like, we don't have a running game if we don't have these top two running backs. Let's just let them go out there and see what happens because you're going to need a little bit of magic. I mean, as you know, going to Blacksburg, it's tough. Like you're going to need something special, even with a Virginia Tech team that's struggling this year. I was just talking to a guy that writes on Virginia Tech. Like he was going through the amount of talent on that team. Like that team still has a ton of talent. I know they've been disappointing. And some of that can be coaching. I mean, they're 1-12 in one possession games, but they still have really good players over there. So you're going to need a little bit of extra juice out there. Real quick on Noah Vonn, 10 carries for 44 yards in the game. I thought he played well in the snaps that he did have. And I know Tony Elliott, he said he's the most complete back on the roster, but he dealt with injuries early in the year. So I would feel comfortable with him being there. It would just be, you don't have the depth. To kind of last an entire game. So you're going to have to kind of manage that. Defense, I got a hit on them. I mean, they've played well. I know SMU had a lot of talent, brings a lot of speed. You saw in that screen pass, the 52-yard screen pass. And of course, who's there to make the play to keep him out of the end zone? It's Jonas Sanker. Big surprise there. But the defense held SMU under their season average for total yards and points, one of the best offenses in the country. A couple guys I wanted to highlight to mention Jonas Sanker, another solid game for him. Can't remember a bad complete game that he's put out there. Kempton Shine is a guy I don't feel like has gotten a lot of shine this year, but I think he's kind of been solid. Teams just usually throw to the other side because Jam Jackson seems a little bit more of a easier target to throw against him or Kendrin Smith, whoever's in at corner. And then how about Billy Kadelka? Walk on defensive lineman, kind of thrown into duty with Ben Smiley out for the game. I was keeping an eye on him just because he's an interesting guy, former lacrosse player, walk on guy. He's not the same player, but you know, that story reminds you of a Patrick Kearney.
Kearney, yeah.
Yep. But just to watch his effort out there, like the guy was, he was getting in the backfield constantly. He doesn't have the, you know, experience to kind of turn those into plays every time, but he finally got that sack and forced fumble at the end. So any of those guys you want to touch on?
I love Billy's story because this is like two games in a row where a reserve has gotten in and really taken advantage of the snaps. Like Diada was like that versus Notre Dame, came in, took advantage of his snaps. So now you can get more meaningful snaps, like in the real process of competing, not when the game's out of hand. So Billy did the same thing. Jonas has been dynamic for us. He's one of the best safeties in the country. The only safety I feel like I always say would be better than Noah is the safety we played against from Notre Dame.
Xavier Watts, yeah.
Yeah. I feel like Jonas is that special. And a little home cooking because he come from Charlottesville, and I've been knowing him since he was in high school. But like you said, Kim Deshaun has definitely been solid. Jam has been asked to be on the island a lot. So Jam has struggled versus those rookie routes with the RPOs, but he just continues to battle and fight. Like defensively, I say this about Coach Rudd and all his assistants. They get the most out of the talent. They get the very most. Schematically, they play to what each individual does well. They'll feature them in certain calls that they make, and those young men respond. I know because we've been losing, and you see the total score, and you're like, what a defense. Couldn't play good. They gave up XYZ points. But it's like, bro, like Notre Dame, anytime Notre Dame started in their side of the ball, the 10 times they did, they only scored twice.
Yep.
Other than that, they got the interceptions, it was big returns, but they've been playing really, really well, man. And we had injuries at linebacker. We had Dorian Jones and Trey McDonald starting. I thought they came in and played well. They played well. Like, guys are really prepared to step in and do their job. So you just applaud that defensive staff. I can't say much more about how proud I am how that staff has that defensive squad. Like prepare night in and night out.
No, you make a really good point. It just seems like, you know, they don't have a ton of talent, you would say, on that side of the ball. Like there's one guaranteed all ACC player, and that's Jonas Sanker.
Yeah.
Cam Robinson is another one that is around that level, but he's been banged up lately. And, you know, in this game, he was kind of limited to just kind of coming in on pass rush situations. And he's been banged up all year. I asked Tony Elliott how much he's just been kind of taped together just to get out there and make a couple plays. Like, you know, he's a special talent, but yeah, like outside of those two guys, everyone else is just kind of, they just do their job and, you know, they give a maximum effort. And to go back to Kadelka, it's not like, you know, he's going to make, you know, so many big plays, but at this point in the season, when some guys can have their heads down, you just need a guy to go out there and give that kind of effort. And yep. That's what I saw out of him. Cam Butler's another one I think was giving a ton of effort out there. He had two quarterback hurries in this one, never made it to the quarterback, even though I think the booth kept announcing that it was Cam Butler that had the sack. And I'm like, no, it was not. I was watching Billy Kadelka from the moment that ball was snapped and watched him get the sack. But yeah, just a lot of guys giving good effort out there. And that's really all you can say for this defense. And that's something to hang your hat on.
No quitting on that defensive side. Like, no, any individual that plays defense is no quitting at all.
No. It was another loss at Scott Stadium. UVA now 2-10 in home ACC games under Tony Elliott. The last two have been not pretty, to say the least, with UNC and SMU. And then the fan base kind of responding to that, the second lowest attendance of the season. They said 36,000. They might have juiced the numbers, I don't know. But I was surprised that, and it kind of filled in as the first quarter got along, which it always does to a certain extent. But pregame, I was like, I don't know, this might be the lowest. But yeah, they got a couple more in there. Just the home record, anything that sticks out to you there?
Yeah, the loss to Carolina. I don't like to lose to Carolina, especially like that. Got smacked. I mean, it's disheartening. Three of the last four games we played, we won the last, so we won one. But the three losses, all three of those losses have been bad losses. It's not, it ain't been like Louisville. It's not been like the Maryland game when you right there. It's been belt to hind parts, like smack, 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 smack. Didn't I tell you, go sit down, get in your room type of beatings. Like, it's been bad. And it's been, you understand why the fan base, you know, like some previous coaches' past transgressions are placed upon the current head coach. It's not fair, but it's just what it is. So when we ran out there and got that flag after getting that fourth down play for 12 men on the field, I knew people was like, oh, see, he's just like Mike. Remember Mike London used to do it? So it's like, ah, God, you can't do that. But, you know, our fan base just want a consistent winner. And you got to keep chipping away. It's five wins. You got a chance to get six. You know, some fans still don't see that as like an improvement or something. Like, bro, we won three games the past 2 years. You could possibly go to a bowl game. Like, sometimes you got to appreciate the small victories. It's not making excuses. You don't skip steps when you elevate. You really, like, some schools do. Don't get me wrong. But we not them, apparently. I know they always point out, well, this coach did this in this many years. We don't got that. So you got to appreciate what you got, because if you keep just playing revolving doors, you're not going to create a sustained culture. We just don't have a sustained culture. We're trying to build it, but it's tough because of the previous regime, you know, those past couple of years and how we left. And now we feel like we're back to square one. It's like, we're just really trying to build it, really trying to build it. And nobody wants to be patient, because it's like, man, they've been patient for over a decade, how they felt. They had finally got three straight bowl seasons. Then we were eligible years after that, and we didn't play it. When we were supposed to play SMU in the Pinstripe Bowl?
Fenway Bowl, yeah.
Fenway Bowl. So, yeah, so I used to be one of the guys that used to go at the fan base like, man, y'all just talking. But as I start to mature and I really assess everything, I'm like, all right, I understand. So I understand why we were like, I really do, bro. Like right now, you gonna catch me going at a fan, because it's like, man, they feel like that's their feelings. I can't tell them how to feel. I really can't. It's not fair to tell a fan how they should feel. You are right in the way you feel. You really are. I could just try to give you some hope, because I'm a really positive guy, and that gets me in trouble a lot. But that's worked for me more than it hurt me being positive. So I'm the wrong guy to be there ready to give you that butt whipping, because I'm going to try to give you some positivity.
And we talked about it a lot early in the season when, you know, it was like the Maryland game and there still wasn't a lot of people out there, and then Boston College and Louisville. And there's the team was doing well at that point. And you're like, why aren't people showing up? And, you know, everyone was like, they're waiting for the other foot to drop. They're waiting for these results that have come towards the end of the season. And I don't know if that's necessarily fair or not, but it is kind of what it is. That's funny you mentioned Mike London. That's the second Mike London reference I've heard today.
Just shout out to Mike, man. Mike, my guy. You know, I don't mean no harm, Mike, but that's, they correlate little things like special team mistakes and legal substitutions to you. Yeah. They do. You know, if we ever throw to a lineman, that ain't going to be your regime. It's going to be the previous regime we throwing to offensive lineman.
Oh, that's funny, because they weren't even comparing Mike and Tony. They're comparing Mike London to Brent Pry in Virginia Tech. that's the comparison. Speaking of Brent Pry and Virginia Tech, got to mention it. 1998, 26 years ago, that was the last time Virginia won in Blacksburg. You remember anything from that game?
Yeah, I remember a lot. I mean, that game is etched in my head just because of the leadership I saw from our seniors, like a Wally Rayner, Aaron Brooks, and of course Anthony Poindexter at halftime. But I really got to see how you could be at the depths of hell, getting your butt whooped by a rival, seeing the injured captain come in, fire you up, and instead of just being lip service, the defense just say, we got you. Because the offense was thinking it up. And the defense was like, we got you. And they set it off with Byron Thwaites pick six. So it was like everybody just started making plays. Boom, just boom, 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 boom. It was just like a movie. And then it was like, hey, you're a part of this movie. Hey, you, get ready to catch this ball. And it's like one play. One play just created the legacy that I have. It's just like Eminem was right. You get one shot, one opportunity. I dropped that pass. Probably ain't got no Ball Hawk show. You're probably not talking to me every Thanksgiving. Yeah. You know, so I'm very appreciative, and you know, and it was in Lane Stadium against your rival. Like, what better place except Scott Stadium? But down there in Lane, I was saying, "Daddy's home" after that game. But since then, we ain't won. So I was like, ah, now I'm a curse. So sometimes I just want them to win so we could get that proverbial animal off our back. You know, like Steve Young said when he won the Super Bowl, you know, for the 49ers. So I appreciate everybody always highlighting it, but I wish they would highlight and say, you know, Virginia has won since then. That's the one thing I really want. I really want, you know.
If it happens, I have a good feeling people will stop, you know, referencing that game every other year back in Blacksburg. But Daddy's coming home to Blacksburg. He's been gone for a while, but he's going to Lane Stadium now. And now in your new role in the announcing booth,
they will get you. They will get you for that. Because I said that day. But see, you beat Petty Hawk to it. I won't gonna bring Petty Hawk. But Daddy's home. Daddy's in the booth. You know, waving hi to all my kids. Salute to look, as much as like tongue in cheek, I do respect Virginia Tech and that energy. Yeah, I was telling somebody, I was telling John at the conclusion of the SMU game, what those fans give those players is a superpower. And I saw it firsthand that year because we were way better than them, way better than them. And they came out thumping us. And that fan and that place was rocking. And I'm looking around like, this trash can juice team beating us this bad. And they just felt like the Monstars, and we were just the cartoons without Michael Jordan, with you know, the Looney Tunes. I was just like, that stadium gives them superpowers. Playing against UVA really give them superpowers. They turn into nasty individuals when they play against them. They really nasty people. Like some of my brothers I grew up with playing with Tech. I'm like, when do you become so nasty? Like, what did I do to you? But it's a rivalry.
It's the running joke. Even the worst Virginia Tech team and the best Virginia team, like you can't predict anything. And that's, you know, they've gone into this game and since 2012 seven times, and they have been fighting for bowl eligibility, and they have won every single time. Last year they did. People forget about. I think it was a couple, not too long ago. Not too long ago, but you know they were 4-6, and they had needed to. If they won that game, they were going to schedule another game so they could get the bowl eligibility.
Oh, yeah.
And they scheduled Marshall. So, yeah, this is – they're well accustomed to coming into a game like this and doing this.
I will say this, not to cut you off. I don't smoke, but I'm going to bring a cigar to the stadium. Just let us win. I'm going on the field with a cigar. And I need day cops to let me on the field. Like they cops, now I ain't gonna say what cops from what county or whatever, but I got video of y'all. Hey, you come on, what are we doing? So I expect the same hospitality. It ain't gonna happen from Lane Stadium. If we win, hey John, Matt, close the show. I got something I got to do, baby. I'm going down there.
Well, listen, you got John and Matt to have your back in that situation. We'll hope for it. We'll see what happens. Anything else you want to wrap up before we get out of here?
Oh, man, keep doing what you're doing, brother. I appreciate you having me on the show. Appreciate the fan base. As much as it may seem like bad and it won't get better, it's going to get better. It really is like it's going to get better. Just stay the course. Keep the faith. We're going to get it right, man. We're going to get it right. And I know y'all probably, shut up. Drink your own shot the hell up, Juice Ball Hawk. But hey, man, this is me. What else you expect from me, right? I'm the apologist. But I love my Hoos, man. I always got faith that we're going to turn that corner. So we're going to see Saturday at 8 down there in Blacksburg. Much respect to Virginia Tech and how they cheer their fans on. But I hope we silence y'all. It's going to feel so good. Silence y'all and go to this bowl game.
That's it. All right. Thank you, Ball Hawk. We're going to come back in just a little bit and talk about UVA men's basketball down in the Bahamas. We got Zach Carey from Stricken the Lawn to do that. We'll see you after the break. All right, welcome back into the Who's On podcast. Now we're transitioning from football over to basketball, where the results don't get much better. But I got Zach Carey, who does get better, coming on from the Streaking the Line to talk about some UVA basketball from their trip down to the Bahamas from this past week. Zach, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me back on, Preston.
All right. The big take from UVA's weekend in the Bahamas is what, Zach?
Oh gosh. Virginia needs to do some things differently to be a more competitive team in the ACC this season.
I think that pretty much sums it up. Yeah. scores real quick. Lost to Tennessee 64-42. The first half looked promising. I mean, it was an ugly game, but they were down by 1 point at halftime. And then got the doors blown off in the second half. Then lost to St. John's 80-55 in a game that never really felt competitive, even going into the latter parts of the first half. So getting into some of the talking points, I guess my big take is just that right now as a team, they don't look athletic enough. They don't look, you know, cohesive enough. They don't look experienced enough. And I don't think that they have a number one, maybe even a number two option on a good team, like a Final Four or a Sweet 16 caliber team, as we got to witness a couple of teams that might be in contention for those types of games later in the season. So some talking points now coming off of the Bahamas. Who is this really who UVA is, or was it the wrong time, wrong place, aka wrong teams?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I think that's sort of the leading one right now of, okay, how much better can this team be? Is this November basketball against more experienced, more talented, as you said, more athletic teams, or is this just how the season's going to go? I think it really, it's tough to say both, but I think it's both. I think the Tennessee and St. John's are very good teams. I think that Bahamar, those were just three really good teams, and then Virginia, who is still coming along very much. I think that if Virginia played these games in February, they'd probably look better. I don't think that they would win. And so sort of the question is, like, how much closer can they get? Not to necessarily Tennessee and St. John's standards, but, you know, can they play more cohesive basketball? Can they figure out the lineups in a way that's going to suit them best? Can the individual players develop? Like, can they take better care of the ball? Can Andrew Rohde and Day-Day Ames be better on that front? Can the coaches coach up Blake Buchanan and Jacob Kofi and Elijah Saunders and maybe give Anthony Robinson some more minutes to be better on the defensive glass and sort of clean up some of those intangibles that Tony Bennett and now Ron Sanchez always preach? I think that there's definitely tangible room for improvement. Like, I think that the ceiling is much higher than what we saw from Virginia last Thursday and Friday. But how high is that ceiling given this team's experience, given this team's talent, given, you have Isaac McNeely, who I think everyone knows is a very good player, but maybe at least right now in his career would be much better with another guy like a Reese Beekman, or some of the other obviously great players that Virginia has had. So it's tough to say right now. It's tough to say if someone like TJ Power or Elijah Saunders is going to step up in a more meaningful way, especially on offense. That's probably what it's going to take for Virginia to take, you know, a significant jump. But there's a lot of unknowns right now. There's always potential, but yeah, it's sort of a bleak outlook right now, at least.
It's bleak, and I think we've seen over the years. I mean, you mentioned November basketball earlier. How many seasons in a row now has it been that the ACC teams have just gotten out to slow starts in November, can't win those non-conference games, which sets them up poorly on the backstretch, but they're playing better, you know, come NCAA tournament time. Duke finally got a big non-conference win for the conference against Arizona, but looking at Pitt, looked like they were playing well and then, you know, fell off against Wisconsin. So, I kind of settle in with this team. I tweeted out about the inexperience on this team, and I think people saw that as me making an excuse. I'm not trying to, my job is not to make excuses for anybody. My job is just to point out something that people aren't talking about is they're the only team in the ACC that does not have multiple seniors in the rotation. And you could argue at times, did they even have one senior in the rotation? Because Tane Murray didn't play an entire basketball game for Virginia. And, you know, he got some minutes here and there in the Bahamas, just because I think at that point, Ron Sanchez was at the throw a dart at the wall and see what sticks with his rotations. I mean, throwing Anthony Robinson out there when he hadn't played in most of the games up to that point. Kind of shows that. So I think you can get better. The athleticism is really shocking when you see teams like that. I don't honestly think there's many teams that are at that athletic as Tennessee, Baylor, or St. John's in the ACC. So that's one, you know, reason for optimism. But at the same time, like, non-athletic teams in the past have done well. You just have to find ways to make up for those deficiencies. I wouldn't say that you know, Wisconsin team with Frank Kaminsky and all those guys was super athletic. I wouldn't say the Purdue team last year that went all the way to the national championship game was super athletic. There are ways to kind of make up for those deficiencies, but you need great players and you need players to play at a high level. So that's kind of what I'm looking at right now. And I do bring up, you know, the lack of a true number one on this team. It was something that, you know, I was talking with a couple of people about. You know, Isaac McNeely, as great as he is, he really just is better suited to be that off ball guy. He could do a little bit more. He's shown this season with the ball in his hands. I wrote an article for thesaber.com about that. Boy, did that look bad, you know, coming off this weekend. But it just feels like he needs another guy out there. And I was like, gosh, Reese Beekman would have been great on this team just to provide a little bit of athleticism, that ball handling, the sure handedness. But what do you think? Does this team, is it just a bunch of role players, or is there guys that can kind of step up to that level?
Yeah, I think at least as it's currently constructed and probably this season, it is predominantly sort of role players that you'd want to have around a star or a group of stars. I think that, you know, you mentioned the inexperience. This is also a roster that was meant to be around for 2 years. Now, yeah. Who knows? But originally, you know, this team was built for next season, and for this season to sort of be a rebuilding year and getting guys like McNeely and Saunders and Power more experience so that next year they could be those guys. They could be sort of the star players. Whether that would have worked out, who they would have needed to get in the transfer portal, maybe, you know, if Chance Mallory, you know, there's so many what ifs. There's so many what ifs there about like how good that team next year could have been if you brought everybody back and maybe made some key additions. So I think that now in this post Tony Bennett retirement world, it sort of, you take away that promise of next year, because who freaking knows, even if Ron Sanchez does get the job, you're going to lose guys most likely. That's just the nature of it. Without that promise in the future, it's kind of tough to look at this year's team and especially the expectations or the sort of the necessity of this team to perform to try to maintain sort of, you know, that Bennett era with Sanchez sticking around. So, yeah, I mean, right now, I do think that it is predominantly a team of role players, good role players. I think Isaac McNeely, he's been an All-ACC selection. I think he was last year.
No, just missed it.
Really? Just missed it. Okay.
I was surprised too when I looked back. Yeah. Ryan Dunn made honorable mention, and Reese Beekman, I think, was second team.
No, that sounds right. Interesting. Okay. I mixed up Dunn and McNeely there. But I mean, okay, McNeely comes back as a 12 point per game scorer in the ACC. But like, yeah, just after that, I mean, Elijah Saunders has been like a sixth man last year on a decent San Diego State team. And then like Day-Day Ames played a rotational role for Kansas State. Everyone knows about Andrew Rohde, Tane Murray. Like there's just not, there just isn't tangible college basketball experience on this team. And I mean, there's potential. Like, I mean, you know, we can talk about TJ Power, but like, you know, there was a time when people were talking about TJ Power in a pretty significant light coming in into Duke and what Virginia was chasing and what they thought they could get with him out of high school. And you know, I'm high on Blake Buchanan, probably higher than most, and was especially high last year. Jacob Kofi had a first, you know, good couple games in college basketball. So I don't know. It's tough. I think that you look at this team and you kind of just wonder what things would look like a year from now. And who knows if we're going to get that. I think that's the tough part. But yeah, right now, tough to note who exactly is carrying them to significant success this season.
Yeah, anytime you talk to anyone around the program in the offseason, the buildup to the season, what was the number one thing they said? We think we have a really good two-year window to be good in year two. And I think we're kind of seeing why they were so high on year two, because there's good players on this team. But again, it is such a young team. You're starting a lineup with, you know, a junior in Isaac McNeely, a sophomore in Day-Day Ames, another, you know, sophomore in TJ Power, a junior and Elijah Saunders and a sophomore. So two juniors and three sophomores. Every other team in the ACC has multiple seniors in their rotation. I think some teams have up as many as five or six in their rotation. Even Duke, who's largely relied on freshmen, they at least have guys like Mason Gillis and a Malik Brown, who's only a sophomore, but you know, played a lot last year for Syracuse, and then also Sion James. You know, so they have experience in that lineup. So I think that's something that's a little underrated in this, and it's going to take some time, and it's not the finished product that people want to see and expect out of Virginia. One guy you mentioned there and who I'm really interested with is TJ Power. What is TJ Power? I think it's all I can ask at this point. You know, he's a former five-star recruit, a lot of hype around him coming out of high school. And then even, you know, I think Duke fans had kind of soured on him, but you know, Virginia fans were excited, you know, get him out of that Duke environment, let him have some playing time. But he's averaging 2.8 points per game right now and shooting 25% from three. And I'm just not sure what is his role at this point.
Yeah, it's tough to say. I think that, I mean, primarily if Virginia wants to get the TJ Power, like if they want to get value from him, he can't keep playing the three. It's just not realistic. Maybe across an entire season, he can get comfortable enough to do it. But I don't think you're getting that high ceiling production from him playing the three. That's just not where he's best, especially right now in his career. I mean, I think we talked about this some preseason. He just doesn't necessarily have the lateral quickness that's going to allow him to play at the three for Virginia to play a jumbo lineup with him. And then offensively, he's just not a ball handler. Like, he's just not making plays off the dribble, really, that, you know, is going to suit Virginia when teams like Tennessee or even Villanova try to pressure them on ball. That's why we've seen Virginia go to three guard lineups a lot. I think if Sanchez and the staff want Power to be a part of this rotation and to contribute, they need to start playing him in that front court rotation alongside Kofi Buchanan and Saunders. They're deep at the four spot. They probably wish that they were a little bit deeper at the one or the three spot, but you know, that's where they're deep, and you know, that's a little bit unfortunate just for fitting guys into the puzzle. Power also just needs to shoot the ball more. I mean, you know, his usage rate is the lowest on the team at 15%. I mean, yeah, he's 4 for 16 from three. He should also probably have taken like 25 threes. He just, you know, he's been open. And I think that, like, if he continues shooting 25%, obviously you take that green light away a little bit, but because of sort of the net negative that he is defensively, which isn't necessarily his fault. He's a young player still adjusting to a scheme and still, you know, needing to develop athletically a little bit. But if he's going to be that net negative on defense, you need him to be a significant net positive on offense. And he just hasn't been so far this season. So, I mean, you know, because Andrew Rohde, you know, 7 for 14 from three is out shooting Power. You know, Jacob Kofi is 5 for 16, not great after, you know, shooting poorly in the Bahamas at 31%, but still better. Saunders is 4 for 10. So if you're going to play Power, I think that Virginia needs to play him at the four. And I think they need to tell him, shoot the ball when you're open, because you're 6'9". Guys aren't going to block your shot very often.
I think a lot of people were more concerned defensively with playing Power at the three. I'm more concerned offensively at this point, because he doesn't have the quickness to beat a three at the college level. And so basically, I haven't done an in-depth film study or anything, but based off the eye test, he is just stuck in the corner and he is just waiting to shoot. And that's why I struggle with, all right, yeah, he's not shooting, he's not playing well, he's kind of played out of position. But also, what is Ron Sanchez, like, what's his vision for TJ Power at this point? Because I don't think there is much of one. I think everything's so focused on, all right, well, how can we get Isaac Neely going? You know, the ball handling situation with Data Ames and Andrew Rohde. All right, Elijah Saunders, he's got to get his post touches. Let's bring Blake Buchanan into the ball screen. TJ Power, just stand in the corner. We'll think about you when we can. And there's a couple times where he's had good looks from the corner and he's still missing. So it's both, you know, him not playing well, but also maybe not being put in the best position to play well.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, I go back and forth. They've thrown it to him into that mid post at times. I mean, that's, you know, Sam Hauser is the obvious UVA comp for TJ Power, at least, you know, the ceiling of a Hauser. I don't think he necessarily has the strength or skill to create points there right now. And then you're right. Like, if he's just going to stand in the corner, that's kind of tough just because, you know, everybody talks about the 3-and-D guys. UVA's had some good 3-and-D guys, some great 3-and-D guys over the years. If you don't have the D part of that, the 3 part of it, you know, if that's all you're doing is shooting threes and playing defense, there's much less value to being able to spread the floor like that. You might as well just put Ishan Sharma in the corner, who's also, you know, I mean, he hasn't shot great. He's 2 for 11, you know, similar to Power, unfortunately, but more mobile defensively, can handle the ball, can bring it up some. You know, same thing goes for Tane Murray and other guys on this team. So, yeah, I think that there needs to be a concerted effort to finding ways. I mean, I would like to see Power used in ball screens more. You know, how good of a screener he is, how strong he is, that's probably up for debate. And maybe that's why the coaching staff haven't used him in that way. But I think that that's part of the benefit of potentially playing him at the four, getting a slower player on him who's going to have a tougher time guarding ball screens, and then throw him in there some and allow him to pop onto the perimeter and create space. Especially for a guy like Day-Day Ames who can maybe attack the paint. But yeah, Virginia's going to have to find ways if they want Power to be a significant part of this team to get him more involved.
One of the reasons I thought it could work before the season was because I think Elijah and TJ could kind of be interchangeable, especially defensively. You get Elijah on whoever the other team's better perimeter or big man option is. You saw it against Tennessee before he was cramping. He was guarding Chaz Lanier a lot. And then kind of lost him, and you had McNeely on Lanier for most of the rest of the game. And McNeely has improved defensively, but you know, that's a tough comp. You know, it's a tough draw defensively. But it just feels like, is it that simple? Like, can you just switch nominally who is there? Or is it like, I think the other team realizes like, all right, we're still going to stick our three guy on TJ Power because like, you know, Elijah Saunders is the one that's going to get post touches.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's the thing. Like, Power's size doesn't really get you much on offense other than being able to, you know, release the ball against a taller opponent. And so, like, because his size doesn't do much for you on offense and his size is a net negative on defense, it gets tough. And maybe things get better. Maybe, I mean, it's 5 games, so maybe I'm overreacting. But yeah, I think Virginia needs to change it up, and I think they need to go more heavily into the three guard, to playing three guards. And just briefly, like, I mean, we talk about sort of like this team's potential and its athleticism and, you know, the lack of maybe sort of quality guard play. It's also just a shame that Elijah Gertrude isn't, you know, on this team. And, you know, I mean, Jalen Worley transferring out, that obviously hurts as well. And I think most dominant, it hurts the depth. You just don't have another guard that you can throw out there, another defensive piece that you can have out there. Offensively, sort of a question mark what he would have been. But in Gertrude, you know, if you have Gertrude or you have Worley, I mean, Ames probably filled the Gertrude spot. You know, it's a roster machinations and whatnot. But if they had Gertrude on this team, that's a lot more athleticism. That's a guy who can guard on the perimeter, who can potentially make plays off the dribble. I don't want to overhype what he would have been in year two, but I think that some of the key things that Virginia is lacking, especially as you look at the backcourt depth, not having Elijah Gertrude right now, is you feel that pain a little bit.
I mean, he's probably the best athlete on the roster. I don't think there's a ton of debate.
Probably. Yeah, probably.
We looked at this Virginia offense, and it was interesting hearing Ron Sanchez kind of talk about it too, is that they're just so over reliant on the 3-pointer right now. And in those 2 games, they were outscored 68-26 in the paint. And someone was like, well, they shot pretty well against St. John's, you know, obviously Tennessee, they didn't shoot well, but against St. John's, they shot pretty well. I was like, yeah, but they still just got, you know, outplayed in the paint and they can't get anything going in there. And I've talked about it a couple times this year already. Day-Day Ames really seems like the only guy that's going to be able to get into the paint, and they don't have anyone else that can kind of get those buckets inside.
Yeah, it's pretty funny looking at the analytics for Virginia this season. Last year, they were 294th in the country in three-point rate, as in three-point attempts divided by field goal attempts. This year, so far, they're 7th. And they're shooting 38.9%, which per KenPom is 32nd in the country. So yeah, I mean, they're taking threes, which was like a big thing last year that just wasn't there, and they're making them. But kind of, yeah, everything else on offense is tough. I mean, their turnover percentage is 336th. Their offensive rebound rate is 352nd. Their free throw rate is 276th. They're not shooting well from 2-point range. I mean, they're shooting slightly better from the free throw line, but not that much better than last season. It's tough. Like, and we sort of saw Elijah Saunders get found out against that athleticism of Tennessee and St. John's. That, oh, okay, this post presence, you know, the sort of mid post presence Virginia thought it had, doesn't quite against the best at. Maybe in the ACC he will, and maybe he'll figure things out. Maybe if he gets healthy, he can play, you know, more consistent minutes and isn't dealing with those cramps that you mentioned. He can be more effective. But yeah, without that, I mean, with Ames the only guy who can touch the paint and being sort of a turnover prone player that he's been so far, it's tough. And it's also tough because this offense, it is perimeter based, and Virginia's taking fewer mid-range shots this year, which is absolutely positive. And analytically, yeah, you want to take a lot of threes. I wouldn't hate it if Virginia ended the season taking, you know, being top 30 in 3-point rate. But you also can't shoot 46% from 2-point range. It's just not, you know, a reliable standard. And yeah, then the question becomes, how do you become a better team around there? Well, you probably need to feed your bigs a little bit. You probably need to get them running to the rim. You need to take advantage of that space that you have to try to do some unique things to get going downhill and find ways to get other guards other than Ames, like Rhodey, McNeely, Murray at times, get them lanes to the basket to try to put pressure on defenses that way so that you're not taking and relying so much on 3-point shooting. It's a tough task. I'm not saying that, you know, it's an easy one and it's tough for Ron Sanchez. I've been encouraged at least somewhat by the innovation on offense. I think it's still a little bit too passive schematically. There isn't as much direction or sort of specific goals or even aggression in taking good shots when they come up that there probably should be. So I think that will probably play into it some as well. But yeah, there's a lot of question marks for this Virginia team offensively that St. John's and Tennessee helped to expose.
All right, we'll wrap up on this. Games against Manhattan and Holy Cross this week. What do you want to see out of these two games? Because after that, you got the ACC-SEC Challenge at Florida, and then you've got your ACC opener at SMU. So, you know, some tougher games coming up on the horizon. So what do you want to see this week after that, the disappointment in the Bahamas?
I want fewer than 9 turnovers in both games. I think just it's not attractive. It's not a fun stat. It's not going to be the top line in everybody's story. If you can't take care of the ball, I don't know that much about Manhattan and Holy Cross. I'll be completely honest with you. But if you can't take care of the ball against these two teams, then that's going to be tough. And I don't mean to sound like a broken record or invoke Tony Bennett and Ron Sanchez, but with the pace that Virginia plays at, if you are 336 in the country in turnover rate, you're not going to win many games. So they need to be better there. And I think that starts this week.
You are asking for something that has not happened yet this season. Their season low was 10 turnovers in the opener against Campbell. Since then, it's been 12, 12, 16, and 15. Yeah, not the typical Tony Bennett basketball. But, I mean, that's to be expected when you don't have, you know, a true de facto point guard on this team. Yeah. And you're kind of just trying to piece together who's handling the ball on all these occasions. And you don't have the athleticism to really break some of this pressure. I would say I want to see something from TJ Power. I know we just talked about him. I want to see something. You know, it hasn't gone well for him. I mean, there's a couple guys I could say that about. I want to see Elijah Saunders make it through a game without, you know, dealing with the cramping issues. But you know, that's, we'll talk about Christmas lists at some point later in the year. But yeah, I think I just want to see, you know, even against lower competition, it would be nice to see, you know, TJ Power kind of put together some kind of game. And I want to see what kind of adjustments Ron Sanchez makes coming out of, you know, what they learned in the Bahamas, because he kept talking about, you know, it's a good experience. It's a good opportunity to kind of learn more about your team. All right, well, show me now what you've learned about the team coming back out of that before you have another round of really tough games coming up with Florida and SMU to open the conference season. All right, Zach, appreciate you jumping on and talking with me for the Who's On podcast. Part of the Sabre Podcast Network. Of course, you can check out the Sabre.com all year long for your latest on the Wahoos and football, basketball, and everything in between. You can follow the Who's On podcast on Apple, Spotify, wherever you find your podcast. Leave a 5-star review while you're there. Zach, happy Turkey Day coming up, and hope you have a good Thanksgiving.
Thanks, man. Back at you.
All right. That's it for the Who's On podcast. We will see you later in the week for the preview of that Virginia Tech UVA game in football. That is coming up around the corner. We'll see you then.